comets are beautiful evidence of a young solar system. Short-period comets lose enormous amounts of their mass each time they circle the Sun. They're disintegrating. R.A. Littleton estimated, quote, probably no short-period comet can survive more than about 10,000 years, unquote. But many short-period comets are still surviving. Of course, recent observations of Halley's Comet are still being assessed, and it's very likely that Halley's Comet has a longer life than 10,000 years, but it's still a very limited life. Evolutionists need an old solar system, so they have to get around the comet problem. To do so, they have assumed that there is a hypothetical cloud of spare comets waiting out in space. And they postulate that from this cloud, new comets are kicked into the solar system to replace old comets. Well, there's no evidence at all for this hypothetical cloud, Oort's cloud as it's called. Nor will it stand up to critical scientific analysis. And it's finally ruled out by the fact that all short-period comets have parabolic orbits, not hyperbolic orbits. And this shows that they were not kicked from space into the solar system. Comets are vivid evidence that the solar system is only some thousands of years old. Again, looking at the solar system, dust particles are orbiting the Sun. The Sun's radiation is causing the dust to spiral slowly into the Sun. Now, this should have swept the solar system clear of dust in less than 200 million years, and yet the dust is still there in abundance. Then, if we look out to the really big suns, the O stars and the B stars, with 100,000 times the radiation of our sun, those giants should sweep up their dust 100,000 times faster than our sun does. Yet these giants are nearly all surrounded by huge clouds of dust and gas. Here is evidence of a young universe. And there are other evidences which we just don't have time to discuss. Now, what makes stars burn? The theory of stellar evolution depends on the assumption that stars burn by nuclear fusion, yet this has never been verified by any evidence. If the Sun is burning by nuclear fusion, it would be showering neutrinos on the Earth. But science now finds that it cannot detect anything like the number of expected neutrinos. The missing neutrinos invalidate the nuclear fusion theory. You should be told that there is a good alternative theory, and it is that the Sun, and therefore the other stars too, are burning by their own gravitational contraction. Measurements of the Sun have been made during the past 3 centuries. They show that the Sun has been contracting, that is shrinking, by 0.1 of a second of arc per century. Enough to make the Sun burn. Now, if the Sun is burning by gravitational collapse, that would limit its total lifespan to about 20 million years. And that, of course, is much too short for evolution. And it points to a young Sun, a young solar system, and a young universe, and no evolution. It's no surprise that all this makes the evolution school cling stubbornly to their nuclear fusion hypothesis, despite the evidence against it. There is no scientific justification for saying that some stars are young, some are mature, and some are old. If some stars were young, some middle-aged, and some old, they would have clearly different chemical compositions. But all of them, whether supposedly young or supposedly old, all have roughly the same chemical composition, and so has the interstellar material. There is no real difference in the chemical composition of the various stars and that of interstellar material, that is, the cosmic material between stars. And all this poses a very real enigma for stellar evolution. Again, it's not good science to say that gas clouds contract and form stars. Natural law requires the opposite. A cloud of gas would tend to disperse. It would not contract down to a burning ball. And this is definite, despite a vague newspaper report that astronomers are seeing a star form. I'd say definitely that formation of a star couldn't be detected in one lifetime or in many lifetimes. Then there's the unsolved problem of galaxies. How do galaxies come into being? How a galaxy forms is a total mystery. I assure you, a total mystery. All that's observed in the heavens, all cosmic data, point to degeneration and decay. A degenerating universe, not an evolving universe. Now here is something interesting. A few centuries ago, Bishop Usher, using biblical chronology, estimated that creation took place in the year 4004 BC. Evolutionists have been having a great laugh about this. Well, they should stop laughing. In 1978, solar physicist Dr. John Eddy, speaking at Louisiana State University, he said, and he's an evolutionist, he said that he believes the sun is 4.5 billion years old. But he went on to qualify this. He added, however, I suspect that we could live with Bishop Usher's value for the age of Earth and Sun. I don't think, he said, and listen to this, I don't think we have much in the way of observational evidence in astronomy to conflict with that. End of quote. This eminent solar physicist and evolutionist was really saying that the bishop's estimated age of 6,000 years for Earth and Sun is every bit as worthy of belief as the evolutionist's age of billions of years. It means that there is nothing in science that can deny you the right to believe that the sun and the galaxies came blazing from the hand of God. Unfortunately, even godly people now think with the Big Bang mind, which simply cannot envisage instantaneous creation of Earth and universe. And yet, Thomas Huxley, who was Darwin's greatest ally, Darwin's bulldog, Thomas Huxley, enemy of religion, champion of evolution, Thomas Huxley conceded that if he could believe in God, he would have no difficulty in accepting that the whole universe could have appeared instantly out of nothingness at the command of that God. Well, if Thomas Huxley could accept that, what is stopping those who do believe in God? We know that science has been busy explaining how the universe got there without God. But I'm sure some of you would like some evidence of instantaneous creation of the Earth. The evidence is found in the great basement rocks of the Earth and what are called radio halos in those rocks. These radio halos are tiny bubbles of discoloration of the rock caused by radioactive decay. When uranium decays, it forms a bubble of discoloration, and it forms several isotopes of the element polonium. We're most interested in polonium-214, which is born, then disintegrates and is gone, vanished, in less than a minute. But in its short life, polonium-214 also marks the rock with its own special radio halo, or bubble of discoloration. Today, we never find polonium except in association with uranium. However, in the great Precambrian rocks, there are found countless polonium radio halos, and this polonium was never associated with uranium. These were free polonium particles, which came into existence independently. They lived their few moments while they made their halos on the rock, and then they vanished. And now the interesting bit. Radio halos will not form in molten rock, nor in very hot rocks. They form only in solid rocks which are cooler than 300 degrees centigrade. This means that those polonium halos could not form in Big Bang rocks, which supposedly took ages to cool and solidify. The only possible explanation is that some free polonium, some primordial polonium, came into existence at the same instant as the primordial rocks came into existence. And inside those solid new rocks, the polonium imprinted its halo and then was gone, while the solid rocks remained. In other words, the primordial rocks materialized instantaneously, and in the same instant, polonium also materialized inside the rocks. The polonium, during its few moments of life, imprinted its radio halos in the rocks, and then disintegrated and vanished. Evolutionists have no answer to explain the mystery of the radio halos, but creationists see the polonium radio halos as the Creator's signature in the rocks. The international authority on radio halos, the highly respected Dr. Robert Gentry, was forced to regard these halos as evidence of instantaneous creation of the Earth. And this changed Dr. Gentry from an evolutionist into a believer in literal six-day creation. Now, the red shift. Astronomers noted something curious. When light from distant galaxies was put through the spectroscope, they saw the spectral lines of elements were shifted towards the longer wavelength end, the red end of the spectrum. They interpreted this on the Doppler principle. They said that the galaxies must be speeding away from us, thereby stretching out the light wavelengths and making the light seem redder. They also noticed that the galaxies which they regarded as more and more distant had greater and greater red shifts. This suggested greater speeds as the distance became greater. So the red shift was regarded as a measure of distance of a galaxy and also as a measure of its speed. Also, the red shift was regarded as evidence that the universe is expanding in all directions. Thus, a new cosmology was born on one thing, the Doppler interpretation of the red shift, and we'll question that shortly. The next step was to hypothesize the expanding universe had been caused by an explosion, the popular hypothesis of the Big Bang. This supposes that all matter or energy was once concentrated in a super-dense state and that it exploded in an almighty explosion, sending the mass energy rushing outwards. Out it rushed and eventually formed into hydrogen and some helium. And after great time, these outrushing gases formed into stars and galaxies and planets and animals and us. Well, let's stop there and raise some objections. First objection: where did the super-dense matter energy come from? The first law of thermodynamics rules that matter is not being created or destroyed. Big Bang theorists have no answer to this objection except to suggest that matter may be eternal. Second objection: the super-dense matter would not have exploded. Rather, it would have collapsed under its own gravity into a great black hole. Third objection: how would stars form? How could a diffuse cloud of gas condense into a star? The Big Bang clouds would not condense into stars. They would expand and dissipate. Fourth objection: what about galaxies? If you can't explain formation of stars, how do you explain galaxies? Nobody can explain galaxies. Nobody has even come up with an even credible proposal of how a galaxy could form. Fifth objection: how would planets form? If you think that tiny bits of matter would stick together and gradually build up a planet, forget it. Bits of matter would not stick, not unless they were a kilometer or more in size, big enough to be gravitationally active. There is no scientific explanation of how to build a planet, much less an entire solar system. You know, evolutionists are imagining other solar systems out there in space. Yet our own solar system defies natural explanation. It's a mystery. Theories have come and gone for 300 years, but science gets no nearer to explaining the solar system. And now the moon rocks have added a bit more to the mystery. They show that the moon and the Earth are so different, they must have had different origins. It seems Isaac Newton gave the answer when he declared that our solar system can only be the product of intelligence, that is, of creation. The Big Bang hypothesis breaks the unbreakable laws of thermodynamics at every stage, as it tries to assemble the wondrous universe from outrushing clouds of gas, from gas clouds that could not develop into anything more complex than gas clouds. Sir Fred Hoyle has stated, "Big Bang cosmologies lead to a universe that is dead and done with almost from the beginning." And he added, The notion that galaxies form is an illusion. Nothing forms. The thing is as dead as a doornail. End of quote. As regards the red shift, we must remember that the Doppler interpretation is pure assumption, and other explanations of the red shift are being proposed. Also, there are objections that many galaxies have red shifts that don't correspond with their supposed distances. Also, claims are made that some bodies have different redshifts, though they're supposed to be at the same distance. Then the quasars present special problems. These quasars are radiating much more energy than their size would permit. This suggests that they can't be as distant as their redshifts indicate. Also, a quasar can have more than one redshift. Some have been observed with as many as five redshifts. Finally, I refer to The New Scientist, 20th of June, 1985, and an article by John Gribben titled Galaxy Red Shifts Come in Clumps. Gribben says that any suggestion that the simple interpretation of the red shift may be wrong, or at least incomplete, sends shivers down the spines of conventional cosmologists. His article then proceeds to discuss new theories of the red shift by W.G. Tift of the University of Arizona. Tift proposes that the redshift is somehow an intrinsic property of a galaxy, an intrinsic property that is not related to expansion velocity at all, not related to expansion velocity, but an intrinsic property whereby redshifts take up preferred states like the quantized energy within an atom. Well, that must send shivers down some spines. But Gribben says that whether Tift is right or wrong, his work is now respectable enough to give both observers and theorists something to chew on. Well, to sum up, the Doppler interpretation of the redshift is basic to modern cosmology. If this Doppler interpretation is wrong, then the whole hypothesis of an expanding universe and a Big Bang falls apart. The redshift thing is in such controversy that you can disbelieve the expanding universe and its Big Bang and still be in good scientific company.